Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And we need to continue in our appeals to heaven to learn, pray, and act. And let us focus on the Constitution, compliance, full compliance. We got to quit cherry picking and demand everybody support the concept of holding everybody accountable to every line of the Constitution. So no more compromises, not for this or that. And I think that's covered everything, Tammy, so I think we're ready to go. Today, folks, we're going to wrap up the new, the Virginia debates, and we will be diving into the Carolina debates, the North Carolina debates. And because technically we would be doing the New York debates, but for the most part, I just, you know, out of interest of time and out of my just lackluster care for anything that Hamilton has to say, since he spoke out of both sides of his mouth, it's almost like, what's the point? What the heck is the point? So anyway, I'm looking at Monroe. We're on the 25th of June. And as a matter of fact, the next day is the day New York begins their debate. I think it's the 26th when they start their debate. So Monroe's talking about commissions. And so, again, he's an anti-federalist, but this is worthy of going through. So let's go ahead and dive into this one, okay?
Okay.
All right.
Mr. Monroe, he could not conceive that a conditional ratification would in the most remote degree endanger the Union, for that it was as clearly the interest of the adopting states to be united with Virginia as it could be her interest to be in union with them. He demanded, if they would arm the states against one another and make themselves enemies of those who were respectable and powerful from their situation and numbers, he had no doubt that they would, in preference to such a desperate and violent measure, come forward and make proposition to the other states, so far as it would be consistent with the general interest. Adopt it now, unconditionally, says he, and it will never be amended, not even when experience shall have proved its defects. An alteration will be a diminution of their power, and there will be great exertions made to prevent it. I have no dread that they will immediately infringe the dearest rights of the people, but that the operation of the government will be oppressive in process of time. Shall we not pursue the dictates of common sense and the example of all free and wise nations and insist on amendments with manly fortitude? It is urged that there is an impossibility of getting previous amendments and that the variety of circumstances concur to render it impracticable. This argument appears to be fallacious and as a specious evasion. The same cause which has hitherto produced a spirit of unanimity and a
predilection
for the Union will hereafter produce the same effects.
Yeah, so actually, what Monroe's basically saying is he's saying that, hey, there's no way they're going to amend this. And it's a revisiting. It's literally a revisiting of the beginning of the convention. Let's not ratify. Let's make a condition that we'll ratify if we get this. That's exactly what they started off with. And so Monroe makes the final, you know, attempt to basically derail the ratification by Virginia. And instead, they say, well, let's not do this. Well, one state actually did that, and that is the next state, North Carolina. They just chose to wait. Instead of sending it back with a condition, they basically waited. So Because at this point in time, New Hampshire was the ninth state that already ratified. Now, with Virginia ratifying, it became a slam dunk for New York. Now, I believe New York, everybody had ratified except for North Carolina. And I think their logic was, well, why should we jump into this now? We can wait a year. What are we going to miss? So anyway, let's go ahead and go back into what he was saying.
Okay. How did the Federal Convention meet? From the beginning of time, in any age or country, did ever men meet under so loose, uncurbed a commission? There was nothing to restrain them but their characters and reputation. They could not organize a system without defects. This cannot, then, be perfect. It is not presumable that by subsequent attempts we shall make it more complete and perfect.
Yeah.
Okay. What are the great objections now made? Are they local? What are the amendments brought forth by my friends? Do they not contemplate the great interests of the people and of the Union at large? Mm-hmm. I am satisfied from what we have seen of the disposition of the other states that instead of disunion and national confusion, there will be harmony and perfect concord. Disunion is more to be apprehended from the adoption of a system reprobated by some and allowed by all to be defective. The arguments of gentlemen have no weight on my mind. It is unnecessary to enter into the refutation of them. My honorable friends have done it highly to my satisfaction. Permit me only to observe with respect to those amendments that they are harmless. Do they change a feature of the Constitution? They secure our rights without altering a single feature. I trust, therefore, that gentlemen will concur with them.
Okay, because he made this last-ditch dance, it kind of makes me recognize that Monroe, even though he was friends with Thomas Jefferson, even though he was friends with Madison, it's obvious that he didn't see the Constitution in the same light. And you know, I'll always look at Monroe as the last real Republican, because John Quincy Adams was really kind of his own man, even though he kind of was riding on the shirt strings of the Republican tenor from Jefferson, Madison, and then Monroe. I really saw Monroe as the one that was willing to go outside the Constitution, where the Missouri Compromise and a lot of other things were happening, where I'm going, why in the heck was Monroe allowing this to happen? The Public Lands Act of 1820. All of these things were all coming to be under his administration or under his tenure as the president. So I don't know. He doesn't deserve a gold star, even though he happened to be the only other president that was practically unanimously selected for presidency. He had all electors except for one withheld their vote. In other words, he didn't have a dissenting vote from any elector. He got all of them except for one person withheld their vote because they didn't feel he deserved full unanimous selection. So anyway, kind of interesting character. But one last comment, and this is the final comment. This is actually from Mr. Ennis regarding the treaty with Britain. So go ahead.
But we are told that we need not be afraid of Great Britain. Will that great... that warlike, that vindictive nation lose the desire of revenging her losses and disgraces? Will she passively overlook flagrant violations of the treaty? Will she lose the desire of retrieving those laurels which are buried in America? Should I transfuse into the breast of a Briton that armor patrice which so strongly predominates in my own, he would say, while I have a guinea, I shall give it to recover lost America.
Yes. And so, being kind of like one of the very last comments, it was just obvious that this comment of, well, we're going to have these treaties, we're going to have these problems with Britain, and sure enough, they did. Even though at this point in time, there was enough tranquility that they had the ability to pass or ratify the Constitution. Now, we're going to turn to the North Carolina debates. And the very first comment that we have in this is, let me see here, all the way down to, and you'll notice that the comments kind of stick out instead of indented, right? So it's Mr. Caldwell regarding We the People. You see that? This is July, July 24th. You got to go down right before, let me see, where's July 25th? Slaves. Well, shoot, there's quite a bit. I mean, they're actually covering a lot of different comment. It's down, you have to scroll beyond the bottom of the view pane where it says, We the People. It's, you see it? You got it? Okay. All right, great. That's where we're going to start.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, if they mean we the people at large, I conceive the expression is improper. Were not they who framed this Constitution the representatives of the legislature of the different states? In my opinion, they had no power from the people at large to use their name or to act for them. They were not delegated for that purpose.
Now, I don't believe anybody's going to get into this, but we covered this under the Constitutional Convention, that the original language stated, we the people of the sovereign state of Delaware, we the people of the sovereign state of Connecticut, we, and they listed all 13 states in a very formal manner, and it took up a whole page, practically. And in so doing, they felt that, hold on here, what if Rhode Island doesn't ratify? What if a couple of states don't ratify? Well, then the Constitution would have been wrong. So they just got rid of we the people of all the different states and just kind of put it into a general statement. But again, it's a preamble. What is a preamble? A preamble is only a declaration of what is to follow. It's not granting powers. It's not really anything. It's just helping declare, you know, the information that's going to follow is going to do this. So anyway, Mr. Archibald McLean.
The Reverend gentleman has told us that the expression, we the people, is wrong because the gentlemen who framed it were not the representatives of the people. I readily grant that they were delegated by states, but they did not think that they were the people, but intended it for the people at a future day. The sanction of the state legislatures was in some degree necessary. It was to be submitted by the legislatures to the people so that when it is adopted, it is the act of the people. When it is the act of the people, their name is certainly proper. This is very obvious and plain to any capacity.
Okay. Now, they're going to go down the path of, again, talking commissions again. So, Mr. Davey makes a comment regarding this concept of exceeding their commission. So, let's go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, the observation of the rendered reverend gentleman is grounded, I suppose, on a supposition that the Federal Convention exceeded their powers. This objection has been industriously circulated.
In other words, very vigorously circulated.
Say that again?
It's very vigorously circulated. In other words, they're trying to enterprise this concept that they exceeded their commission.
But I believe, on a candid examination, the prejudice on which this errors is founded will be done away. As I had the honor, sir, to be a member of the convention, it may be expected I would answer an objection personal in its nature, and which contains rather a reflection on our conduct than an objection to the merits of the Constitution. After repeated and decisive proofs of the total inefficiency of our general government, the states deputed the members of the convention to revise and strengthen it. And permit me to call your consideration that whatever form of Confederate government they might devise or whatever powers they might propose to give this new government, no part of it was binding until the whole Constitution had received the solemn assent of the people.
Agreement by the people.
What was the object of our mission? To decide upon the most effectual means of removing the defects of our federal union. This is a general discretional authority to propose any alteration they thought proper or necessary.
Mm-hmm.
Were not the state legislatures afterwards to review our proceedings? Is it not immediately through their recommendation that the plan of the convention is submitted to the people? And this plan must still remain a dead letter or receive its operation from the fiat of this convention. Although the federal convention might recommend the concession of the most extensive powers, yet they could not put one of them into execution. What have the convention done that can merit this species of censure? They have only recommended a plan of government containing some additional powers to those enjoyed under the present feudal system, amendments not only necessary, but which were the express object of the deputation.
Now remember, we already went through this at the beginning of the year when we went through all of the amendments to the Articles of Confederation that all fell flat because one state continually said no amendments, which was Rhode Island. So there was no way they could save the Articles of Confederation. They had to change it. They had to change that 100% threshold of everybody buys into it. And they had to make other very serious changes, such as to give them the power of, let's just say, coercive power to get the money out of the states when the states need to pay them, and so forth and so on. So, okay, keep going. Thank you.
Okay, when we investigate this system candidly and accurately and compare all its parts with one another, we shall find it absolutely necessary to confirm these powers in order to secure the tranquility of the states and the liberty of the people. Perhaps it would be necessary to form a true judgment of this important question, to state some events and develop some of those defects which gave birth to the late convention and which have produced this revolution in our federal government with the indulgences of the committee. I will attempt this detail with as much precision as I am capable of. The general objects of the Union are, first, to protect us against foreign invasion. Second, to defend us against internal commotions and insurrections. Third, to promote the commerce, agriculture, and manufactures of America. These objects are requisite to make us a safe and happy people, and they cannot be attained without a firm and efficient system of union. As to the first, we cannot obtain any effectual protection from the present Confederation. It is indeed universally acknowledged that its inadequacy in this case is one of its greatest defects. Examine its ability to repel invasion. In the late Glorious War, its weakness was unequivocally experienced. It is well known that Congress had a discretionary right to raise men and money, but they had no power to do either.
Keep going.
In order to preclude the necessity of examining the whole progress of its imbecility, permit me to call your recollection one single instance, when the last great stroke was made which humbled the pride of Britain and put us in possession of peace and independence. So low were the finances and credit of the United States that our army could not move from Philadelphia until the minister of his most Christian Majesty was prevailed upon to draw bills to defray the expense of the expedition. These were not obtained on the credit or interest of Congress, but by the personal influence of the Commander-in-Chief.
Okay, keep going.
Had this great project miscarried, what fatal events might have ensued? It is a very moderate presumption that what has once happened may happen again. And the next important consideration which is involved in the external powers of the Union are treaties. Without a power in the federal government to compel the performance of our engagements with foreign nations, we shall be perpetually involved in destructive wars. The Confederation is extremely defective in this point also. I shall only mention the British treaty as a satisfactory proof of this melancholy fact. It is well known that although this treaty was ratified in 1784, it required the sanction of a law of North Carolina in 1787, and that our enemies, presuming on the weakness of our federal government, have refused to deliver up several important posts within the territories of the United States and still hold them to our shame and disgrace. It is unnecessary to reason on facts, the perilous consequences of which must in a moment strike every mind capable of reflection.
Okay, so this right here is an insight that most people don't even know. In other words, the fact that there had to be this process, as they basically said, it is well known that although this treaty was ratified in 84, it required the sanction of a law of North Carolina in 1787. And then he points out that the British government was not releasing the posts in the interior, in the western lands, that they promised to actually release or give up. So when we look at the Articles of Confederation, the fact that they were moving forward and the fact that both the United States and Britain were thumbing their nose at the treaty, because both of them were deliberately, violating it, because the United States was not going to pay Britain a penny for those who were kicked out, for the property that was confiscated, those, what we call the loyalists, the Tories, who were kicked out of America, lost everything. And Britain was trying to, you know, get their compensation back so they could, you know, start over. But, America refused to pay. So anybody that says that the United States was just bending over backwards to pay Britain, they don't know what they're talking about. There's no evidence of that even happening, especially when it comes down to that both sides, the United States and even Britain, were violating that treaty. So let's go ahead with the next head under the... Go ahead. Okay.
The next head under which the general government may be considered is the regulation of commerce. The United States should be empowered to compel foreign nations into commercial regulations that were either founded on the principles of justice or reciprocal advantages. Has the present Confederation affected any of these things? Is not our commerce equally unprotected abroad by arms and negotiation? Nations have refused to enter into treaties with us. What was the language of the British court on a proposition of this kind, such as would insult the pride of any man of feeling and independence? You can make engagements, but you cannot compel your citizens to comply with them. We derive greater profits from the present situation of your commerce than we could expect under a treaty, and you have no kind of power that can compel us to surrender any advantage to you. That was a quote.
Yeah, that was a quote, and that was a British quote, by the way. Correct. So, go ahead. Keep going.
This was the language of our enemies, and while our government remains as feeble as it is, as it has been, no nation will form any connection with us that will involve their relinquishment of the least advantage. What has been the consequence? A general decay of trade, the rise of imported merchandise, the fall of produce, and an uncommon decrease of the value of lands. Foreigners have been reaping the benefits and emoluments which our citizens ought to enjoy. An unjustifiable perversion of justice has pervaded almost all the states, and everything presented to our view, a spectacle of public poverty and private wretchedness.
Okay, with that, we're going to go into a break, and so we'll pick it up with the next paragraph. But and so actually, the setup was Mr. Caldwell making, a snide remark regarding it starting off with "We the People" in the preamble, but what Mr. Davey is really doing is he's actually kind of creating this long oration of why this was the way to go. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so he's Mr. Davey is really laying out how the existing system under the Articles of Confederation were just a failure, and what they had to do, and he's speaking really generally regarding the Constitution. So he's not going into defining anything. He was basically saying, hey, this was our mission to basically protect us, to help ensure that we could flourish in commerce and enterprise and so forth. So this is kind of just giving people this beginning segue. So after there was probably plenty of snide remarks that kind of went around. So let's go ahead and pick it up with, while this is a true representation. Go ahead.
While this is a true representation of our situation, can our general government recur to the ordinary expedient of loans? During the late war, large sums were advanced to us by foreign states and individuals. Congress have not been able to pay even the interest of these debts with honor and punctuality. The requisitions made on the states have been everywhere unproductive, and some of them have not paid a stiver. These debts are part of the price of our liberty and independence, debts which ought to be regarded with gratitude and discharged with honor. Yet many of the individuals who lent us money in the hour of our distress are now reduced to indigence in consequence of our delinquency. So low and hopeless are the finances of the United States that the year before last, Congress were obliged to borrow money even to pay the interest of the principal which we had borrowed before. This wretched resource of turning interest into principal is the most humiliating and disgraceful measure that a nation could take, and approximates with rapidity to absolute ruin. Yet it is the inevitable and certain consequence of such a system as the existing Confederation.
Yeah, and so it's kind of interesting because he's making the case that they were incapable. Now, remember, the people that they owed money to was the French. That was one of the primary financiers of our revolution. And they realized at this point in time that it was just a disgrace. They had no idea. This is 1788. They had no idea that in 2 years, heads would be rolling in France, that the French Revolution would be kicked off, and all of these people would basically, because France was in this bad financial way, the people were starving. In other words, our failure to honor our debt really, I'll just say, created a bad economic situation in France that caused that revolution. Does that make sense? So when we look at what was happening, had we not established this constitution so that we could vigorously pay down those debts, had we not done this, then what would Napoleon Bonaparte's first predilection be? What do you think he would say? You know what? I want to march over there to Russia and, you know, just and start taking some resources and land. No, I don't think that would. But I think he'd want to actually get on ships and come to America and get his pound of flesh because we owed that much money. That would have been their very first focus. But again, Bonaparte didn't rise to power in 91. He didn't rise to power in 92. It took a while. And so by the time he got to power, we were honoring our debts. And as a matter of fact, if I remember correctly, there were people that actually went into France. Jefferson wasn't one of them, but I know that there were some, I think John Quincy Adams and some others, because they had spent time in France. They went over there to help some of their friends get out of France because they were, I think, there was a gentleman that spent time here militarily and so forth, and I think Washington wanted to get involved, but he didn't. And I forget the guy's name. He's really well known and was very active in military advisement and that type of stuff in a revolution. And what ended up, because Jefferson and him were pretty good friends, what ended up happening, I believe, is John Quincy Adams convinced, he was over there, and he convinced the French people to allow him to go to another nation. And so, I mean, that guy just barely got away with his life because everybody else was being beheaded and so forth. So, anyway, let's go ahead and pick up the last paragraph before we get into encroachments. Go ahead.
There are several other instances of imbecility in that system. It cannot secure to us the enjoyment of our own territories or even the navigation of our own rivers. The want of power to establish uniform rule for naturalization to the United States is also no small defect, as it must unavoidably be productive of disagreeable controversies with foreign nations. The general government ought, in this as in every other instance, to possess the means of preserving the peace and tranquility of the Union. A striking proof of the necessity of this power recently happened in Rhode Island. A man who had run off with a vessel and cargo, the property of some merchants in Holland, took sanctuary in that place. Application was made for him as a citizen of the United Netherlands by the minister, but as he had taken the oath of allegiance, the state refused to deliver him up and protected him in his villainy. Had it not been for the peculiar situation of the states at the time, fatal consequences might have resulted from such a conduct, and the contemptible state of Rhode Island might have involved the whole Union in a war.
Another nice glowing moment of how Rhode Island was just that stellar member of the Union, right? Okay, so now he dives into encroachments. Now remember that the Constitution is constantly justified over the limitation of powers. So you can just expect that he's going to be talking about that. But it looks like he's really talking about this in more of a grand perspective. So go ahead.
Okay. The encroachments of some states on the rights of others and of all on those of the Confederacy are incontestable proofs of the weakness and imperfection of that system. Maryland lately passed a law granting exclusive privileges to her own vessels, contrary to the Articles of Confederation. Congress had neither power nor influence to alter it. All they could do was to send a contrary recommendation. It is provided by the 6th article of the Confederation that no compact shall be made between two or more states without the consent of Congress. Yet this has been recently violated by Virginia and Maryland, and also by Pennsylvania and New Jersey. North Carolina and Massachusetts have had a considerable body of forces on foot, and those in this state raised for 2 years, notwithstanding the express provision in the Confederation that no force should be kept up by any state in time of peace.
Okay,
as
so
internal
obviously
internal tranquility.
That's okay. I'm sorry. So obviously he's already pointing out, you know, the chaotic state and the disheveled lack of cooperation between the states. So go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Okay. As to internal tranquility, without dwelling on the unhappy commotions in our own back counties, I will only add that if the rebellion in Massachusetts had been planned and executed with any kind of ability, that state must have been ruined, for Congress were not in a situation to render them any assistance. Another object of the Federal Union is to promote the agriculture and manufactures of the states, objects in which we are so nearly concerned. Commerce, sir, is the nurse of both. The merchant furnishes the planter which such articles as he cannot manufacture himself and finds no market for his produce. Agriculture cannot flourish if commerce languishes. They are mutually dependent on each other. Our commerce, as I have before observed, is unprotected abroad and without regulation at home, and in this and many of the states ruined by partial and iniquitous laws. Laws which, instead of having a tendency to protect property and encourage industry, led to the depreciation of the one and destroyed every incitement to the other. Laws which basely warranted and legalized the payment of just debts by paper, which represents nothing, or property of very trivial value.
Okay, so one of the things we're going to find out through North Carolina, because we've actually gotten some information from other states already regarding the devaluation of property and the worthlessness of their paper money. That becomes one of the big reasons why they, you know, pointed to the Constitution, because it required the specie of gold and silver. Now, there's just a lot of yammering and lips flapping and so forth. And then a little bit later down, Mr. Gowdy makes a comment. Now, obviously, Mr. Davy, being the Federalist, you can even probably presume that Mr. Gowdy is an anti-Federalist. So let's see what Mr. Gowdy says, and then Mr. Davy's reply regarding slavery.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, this clause of taxation will give an advantage to some states over the others. It will be oppressive to the southern states. Taxes are equal to our representation. To augment our taxes and increase our burdens, our Negroes are to be represented. If a state has 50,000 Negroes, she is to send one representative for them. I wish not to be represented with Negroes, especially if it increases my burdens.
Uh-huh. Go ahead.
Mr. Davy, Mr. Chairman, I will endeavor to obviate what the gentleman last up said. I wonder to see gentlemen so precipitate and hasty on a subject of such awful importance. It ought to be considered that some of us are slow of apprehension, or not having those quick conceptions and luminous understandings of which other gentlemen may be possessed. The gentleman does not wish to be represented with Negroes. This, sir, is an unhappy species of population, but we cannot at present alter their situation. The eastern states had great jealousies on this subject. They insisted that their cows and horses were equally entitled to representation, that the one was property as the other. It became our duty, on the other hand, to acquire as much weight as possible in the legislation of the Union, and as the northern states were more populous and white, this only could be done by insisting that a certain proportion of our slaves should make a part of the computed population. It was attempted to form a rule of representation from a compound ratio of wealth and population, but on consideration it was found impracticable to determine the comparative value of lands and other property in so extensive a territory with any degree of accuracy, and population alone was adopted as the only practicable rule or criteria of representation. It was urged by the deputies of the eastern states that the representation of 2/5 would be of title of little utility, and their entire representation would be unequal and burdensome. That in a time of war, slaves rendered a country more vulnerable, while its defense devolved upon its free inhabitants.
Okay, so he's kind of covering the conversations that they had. You remember, they talked about these things during the convention, right? And so It boiled down to the necessity for the southern states to have this representation. What really should have happened was, because they made this 20-year importation of slaves, right? So in other words, they were going to import slaves for 20 years into the South, which would have given them a gradual growth of apportionment. Not that they were, you know, more free people. They were actually bringing in more slaves. But by capping it in 20 years, where the migration of people would continue to all of the other states, the South would be capped. Now, I know it's really hard to recognize this, but when you have a developed region like South Carolina and North Carolina, North Carolina was already, it already had a territory that was expanding and actually being developed and became a state just a matter of a couple years after the Constitution was ratified. That was Tennessee. Kentucky came out of Virginia. So the fact that they had an area that was already populated and already well, I don't want to say, you know, well developed, but it was developed to a point where it rightfully became a state right out of the get-go. And as a matter of fact, I'd have to look at the consensus of 1800 to find out what the populations were, but you'll probably find that the populations in Kentucky and Tennessee was actually very high. The point is that when we look at North Carolina and South Carolina and Georgia, the majority of the existing state that we see was very well developed. It wasn't there like there was a lot of really good plantation land left. In other words, when you start going through, the prime land is usually the flat land, right? You don't want to have a farm on a mountainside. You know, like when you look at China, the fact that they actually have to, you know, grow their agriculture on mountainsides is because they don't have hardly any flat land. So they had to live with what they had. And so the flat land, the prime land, got taken up a long time ago. So those established plantations were able to grow a bit with labor, maybe size, but for the most part, they were tapped physically. Any plantation that was being developed in North Carolina was a plantation with disadvantages because it either had forest on it. And what do you have to do to have a plantation? You got to cut down all those trees. You got to excavate all of that and remove those stumps so that you can actually have good plow land. The problem that they had was that it was easier to go to the next state over. So there wasn't going to be much more development in these southern states, North, South Carolinas, and Georgia, which is one of the reasons why we see how Mississippi and Alabama and then Louisiana were pretty much in line with joining the Union pretty quickly. Unfortunately, they were able to maintain slavery going into those states, but bottom line, the design of the Union, the design of the Constitution, was to ensure that the people that gravitated or moved to a state had full control and self-determination of what that state would be. So, unfortunately, these plantations, this is where I say this was America's first franchise. These were family franchises as people were migrating westward into these new areas, into these new state-to-bes. And that's exactly what was happening. By 1820, there were a lot of plantations being set up in Missouri where the majority of the people in Missouri didn't want slavery. So when they recognized that the odds of Missouri becoming a slave state, they said, you know what, we can't allow this. And so if you look at the Missouri Compromise, most people don't examine the Mason-Dixon line. But the Mason-Dixon line was the line that they were going to carve that went from the East Coast over to the West Coast, that all states below that line were to be slave states. Guess where Missouri is? If you look up the Mason-Dixon line, you will see the southern boundary of Missouri sits on the Mason-Dixon line. So in other words, it was technically a northern state. But they had enough money and affluence from these franchises, and we kind of covered this as well, that these large plantations had money, and they were buying influence in Congress to get Congress to actually say, we're going to draw the line that all states below this are going to be slave states, but we're going to make an exception with Missouri. That way, these plantation owners didn't have to pack up and go somewhere else to, you know, down to Arkansas or go further out to Oklahoma or what have you. That makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when we read our history books, there's lots of lies out there that basically state that, you know, Missouri wanted to be a slave state. No, they did not. The money holders, those people that had the affluence but not the votes, because they knew going in, had they not had Congress dictate that they were going to be a slave state, they were going to be a free state. And just 20-some, 30-some years later, during the Dred Scott case, it was a jury of his peers, I should say, of white men. There were 12 white men that set Dred Scott free from slavery. That's how the attitude of the people really was in Missouri. And so this is how, you know, this evil, you know, corruption of money and so forth just became this stain. It became a skid mark on America, if you know what I mean. So anyway, anywho. Let's go ahead and see what, how much time we got. We got 6.5 minutes, so let's keep going.
Okay. On the other hand, we insisted that in time of peace, they contributed by their labor to the general wealth, as well as other members of the community, that as rational beings, they had a right of representation, and in some instances, might be highly useful in war. On these principles, the eastern states gave the matter up and consented to the regulations as it had been read. I hope these reasons will appear satisfactory. It is the same rule of principle which was proposed some years ago by Congress and assented to by 12 of the states. It may wound the delicacy of the gentleman from Guilford, Mr. Gowdy, but I hope he will endeavor to accommodate his feelings to the interests and circumstances of his country.
Okay, so now Mr. James Gallo pipes up and says...
Mr. James Galloway said that he did not object to the representation of Negroes so much as he did to the fewness of the number of representatives. He was surprised how we came to have but 5, including those intended to represent Negroes. That, in his humble opinion, North Carolina was entitled to that number of independent of the Negroes.
Okay, now Mr. Spate is a Federalist. We don't actually hear anything from him now. But the two, on top of Mr. Davy, the two real stellar comments, and probably the one that I think really hits the ball out of the park a lot of times in these debates, is Mr. Iredell, James Iredell. And I usually cite things that he says in our petitions and so forth. And Mr. Spate is another one. So anyway, we digress, but we go down a little bit further, and this is all still on the same day. See all of these comments? All of these comments are all on the very first day of the, or the second day of the convention, third day, the 24th. So we go through all of these comments, keep going, and then finally we get some important thing regarding common law. This is important, you know, and this is by Mr. Iredell, and then Governor Johnston makes a comment, and then the end of the day. I mean, that's a lot of commentary. In other words, the stenographers or the note takers of these debates, they had their hands full. Now, as I understand it, The debates kind of had two or three scribes, or maybe four or five scribes, where they all kind of, you know, did their best to keep up, and then they compared notes and consolidated what was being said by each so that they could create a more accurate picture of, you know, how well they captured the precise words. But there was after, and I remember there was in one of Madison's biographies, there were some points in time where Madison felt that some of his comments were slanted a little disfavorably, but, you know, I read them and I go, you know, maybe there were some points he was making that didn't cross the finish line, but I don't see any way where his comments made any, you know, any dent, or I should say, took any glimmer and shine off of the Constitution of how he was presenting the facts or the stipulating the clauses and so forth. So with less than 3 minutes left, let's go ahead and dive into that common law comment. Go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, the objection would be right if there was no other mode of punishing, but it is evident that an officer may be tried by a court of common law. He may be tried in such a court for common law offenses, whether impeached or not. As it is to be presumed that inferior tribunals will be constituted, there will be no occasion for going always to the Supreme Court, even in cases where the federal courts have exclusive jurisdiction. Where this exclusive cognizance is not given them, redress may be had in the common law courts in the state, and I have no doubt such regulations will be made as will put it out of the power of officers to distress the people with impunity.
Okay. And so the final note by Governor Johnston is that he observed that the men who were in very high offices could not come at by the ordinary courses of justice, but when called before his high tribunal and convicted, they would be stripped of their dignity and reduced to the rank of fellow citizens, and then the courts of common law might proceed against them. So in other words, there was absolutely this dual process of holding public servants accountable. First, the stripping and the embarrassment of being removed from this high station in life, and then going, you know, being stripped and then going into the courts to be held accountable for your crimes. So obviously they were responding to this lack of the state's involvement in being able to hold people accountable. Remember Madison, just previously, a couple of days ago, we covered how Madison basically says there should be no concern about many people being tried in federal courts because 99% of all the crimes would be held and strictly held in state courts, not federal courts. They didn't have that kind of jurisdiction. So, obviously, this was a common problem throughout these states that vigorously debated that they saw problems in the jurisdiction of the federal courts, which is the primary reason why they pulled back on Congress and said, we want an amendment to remove the jurisdiction of the federal courts over the states, controversies between states and citizens of another state, as well as foreigners and so forth, which basically was the 11th Amendment. And that was, I believe, presented in 1794, and ratified in 1798. I know it was ratified in 1798. So with that, thank you for your contributions. We will be back with more regarding the North Carolina debates, and there's a lot to cover here, folks. So with that, we're coming close to actually going through all of the ratification debates and giving you the highlights of proving how this Constitution had been stipulated and clarified so that everybody would be on the same sheet of how we were to follow this Constitution. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.